Hello and welcome to the Viral History Podcast, the place where you can get your history fix in audio form every single episode. It's me and Gemma Chandler, of course, with you as always. And if you want to get in touch, it's really easy to do so on Twitter. It's at @viral_history on Instagram, at Viral History on Facebook and YouTube. You're simply looking for Viral History. And if you want to drop us an email because you're old-fashioned, info@viral-history.com. In the year 1613, Shakespeare was acknowledged as the greatest writer of the age, but disaster strikes when his renowned Globe Theatre burns to the ground. Devastated, Shakespeare returns to Stratford, where he must face a troubled past and a neglected family. Haunted by the death of his only son, he struggles to mend the broken relationship with his wife and daughters. In so doing, he is ruthlessly forced to examine his own failings as a husband and father. I'm, of course, talking about the new Ken Branagh, Ben Elton, Judi Dench film, All Is True, based on the end of William Shakespeare's life. And here to discuss it with myself and Gemma, Dr. Kirsty Rolfe and Dr. Joanne Paul. Hello, thank you for joining us.
Hello, thank you for having us.
Hello.
Let's start by talking about the veracity of the film. So, Kirsty, I was chatting to you a few moments ago off air, and you said you've got some capitalized words in your in your notes, which suggests to me either you're effusive in your praise or you're a tad unhappy.
I'd say more towards the latter, Joe. But it's not necessarily about accuracy, because one of the things that this film does do is it's very much based on research about Shakespeare's life, like research that's quite kind of fairly well known, because Shakespeare's such a kind of massive figure that people have been like digging over archives for every mention of him for several hundred years. And so all this stuff in the film about the law cases and like Shakespeare's sort of relationships, well, we don't obviously know that much about the relationships, but Shakespeare's kind of problem with his father and stuff like that, this is based on kind of verifiable historical sources. My problem really with the film is not that exactly. It's more that it's sort of dull in that we have it's incredibly dull. It takes all of these things which could be footnoted. So when we have like All Is True as the title, you know, taken from Shakespeare's Henry VIII play, yeah, it's all true in some senses, but it's kind of presented in the most sort of like hammering everything home way. So we hear about the second best bed, for example, that he leaves to his wife kind of four or five times. It's hammering historical accuracy in a way that doesn't make for great cinema.
Okay, Joanne, what was your immediate reaction to the film?
I have to say that my overall reaction was very similar to Kirsty's. My immediate reaction was actually I quite enjoyed the opening, sort of for the first third or so of the film. I was thoroughly enjoying myself and had gone in with high expectations and a lot of excitement. But I have to say the moment for me that it switched was about a third of the way in, when they actually have Shakespeare in a conversation about truth and falsity and rumor and so on, say the words, "Well, all is true." And it's just that sort of heavy-handedness and lack of subtlety, I think, that both sort of bored and slightly frustrated me in a similar way as to Kirsty. It was heavy-handed. And when it's a film about Shakespeare, who's all about sort of subtlety and layers of meaning and innuendos, to have something that's just so surface level and stark, I found a little bit, just too much.
I was going to say, I'm going to completely flip that. I had a lovely time. I really liked it. But then I think, as I always need to say, it's that I don't view it in the same way as you two do, when you've got all that background knowledge. I just sat there and had a lovely time. I thought it had a really nice tone to it. I understand what you're both saying about a few bits being overdone almost and kind of repeatedly drilled into you. But I thought it had a really nice kind of feel to it. It was beautifully shot, really beautiful. And I liked the performances. Yeah. And there were some really nice moments of comedy in there, actually. I laughed out loud at one point, I'd say.
I'd have loved there to be more of that, really, because,
I agree.
This is written by Ben Elton, who I think does a really great job with Shakespeare in Upstart Crow. Like, I thoroughly enjoy that. And he, certainly in Upstart Crow, it's like he's not as bound by this need to kind of have some sense of historical accuracy. He can play about a lot more. And that playfulness is really appealing. Whereas there's a real kind of, I mean, you get these moments of comedy, but there's quite a lot of quite dull business in between it.
Yeah. I can't argue with that.
I have to agree with the cinematography. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's a beautiful film. From the opening shot right to the end, there were moments of just, I think, Gemma, too, you said that you found it, was it calming? Was that the word you used?
Soothing.
Soothing, that was it, yeah.
I wasn't very well the night we went to see it, so I don't have any influence on it.
Oh, hello, little bit of nightmare and watch this. Yeah. Lovely.
Slightly drugged up, and maybe that accounts for some of it, yeah.
Can I just ask, is there an element, I suppose, it's for the layman such as myself, this is the lesser known part of Shakespeare's life. And is there an element of laying it on thick? Because as you mentioned, Joe, he's so connected with subtlety and nuance and intelligent writing that you do need to lay it on thick, because we do need to separate the man from his work here. And it's bringing out his personal relationships. It's somebody whose name we all know, but his personal life, his relationship with his wife, his relationship with the Earl of Southampton, and of course his only son Hamnet, who'd passed away, that therefore there's an excuse for it to be a little heavy-handed.
Potentially, I think so. I think I would have enjoyed a film that did focus much more on those relationships, and I should qualify that, because it does. Most of the film is dialogue between him and the various people in his life, and yet they spend a lot of time talking about his work. much of the dialogue is dedicated, honestly, to telling him how great he is and how important he is, except from his family members, who want to do the opposite and tell him that his work actually isn't important and that he's neglected his family, but it still seems to be about his work. I think the acting for that was fantastic, but it did seem to just try to be clever with everything that it was doing, that it wanted to reference these things that we might know, these sort of hooks into Shakespeare, in a way that, just the first time, for instance, the second best bed is mentioned, even the second time, it is quite clever, and you go, oh yeah, you know, maybe that's why he leaves his wife his second best bed, because it has this importance that it does in the film. But again, like with the title, by the fourth time they mention it, they're actually explicitly spelling it out for you. And I just feel that audiences are cleverer than that, especially, you know, an audience member who goes to see a film about Shakespeare might go because they like connecting the dots themselves. They like figuring things out. And I just felt that game, that interest was sort of lost in this film, because everything was just starkly presented.
Should we talk about the characterization? So it's not just Shakespeare, it's Anne Hathaway, played by Judi Dench as well, and the Earl of Southampton, played by Ian McKellen. What did you make of the portrayal of Anne Hathaway? Kirsty, we'll start with you.
I really liked it. And a bit of a caveat on that, one of the things that I've seen brought up in reviews is the fact that we all know that Anne Hathaway was older, and you have this sort of general kind of cultural view of her as like this older woman who seduces the young Shakespeare. He gets married at 18, which, you know, he's still a minor when he gets married to her, and then she gives birth to Susanna 6 months later, so you have this kind of shotgun wedding. And one of the criticisms that I've seen levelled is that by casting Judi Dench, who's like, I think, 23 years older than Branagh, that really plays into that particular reading of her as this much older woman, whereas actually 8 years ain't that big a deal. But I think, well, partly it's Judi Dench, and she does very well with the material. Like, if you want to see Judi Dench, like, really rise above some pretty bad dialogue, this is a really great film for you.
But there's a part where you can, I mean, I'm sure it is. They're trying to drum that point home. But there's maybe a part on the filmmaker's behalf thinking, well, we've got Branagh. We've got McKellen. We can stick Dench in
and that's the magic triangle.
It's like Harry Potter. It's like, how many kind of like screen greats can we get into one film? But I think actually their relationship works really well on screen. Mm. It was one of the things that I thought was pretty great. And like Joe said, the acting in this film is really good. I know that for some people, Branagh is nails on a blackboard. I'm quite agnostic about him. I thought he was fine. Could do without the fake nose, but there we go. But the daughters are great as well. So there's a lot of very, very good performances and very interesting characterization happening here. I think it's worth seeing for that.
Should we talk about the Earl of Southampton, Ian McKellen's role in this film, and the relationship between himself and Shakespeare? Because it's maybe something that most people aren't too aware of.
Yeah, so they play on the idea that Shakespeare dedicates essentially sort of half the sonnets to the Earl of Southampton, the sonnets that are addressed to the fair young man, that they might in fact be addressed to Henry Wriothesley, Earl of Southampton. And this is something that literature scholars, historians have gone back and forth on. We'll never know. Whether they were addressed to a real person, whether it was just a sort of fictionalized trope that he was just playing around with this idea. But in the film, they decide that it is the case. They say quite clearly, Ian McKellen, as the Earl of Southampton says, you know, you address those sonnets to me, and so on. They also they lean into the idea that Shakespeare wrote them for him because there was some sort of romantic feeling, maybe even a sexual feeling. They try to make that idea explicit. Now, Ian McKellen, I loved the entire, he was only in the one scene, sort of one and a half, but I loved him in it. I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah, he was brilliant. So great.
The actual sort of the dialogue and the conversation. Again, maybe it is just me. Maybe it's me as theater goer. Maybe it's me as historian. I'm not sure. But if they had just left that as a sort of indication, rather than making it so explicit, I think personally I would have enjoyed that more. But it was interesting to bring that in. They do also bring in the other sonnets, the Dark Lady, and Anne Hathaway brings that up about her embarrassment. That these sonnets were being passed around, where he is addressing his love for another woman, and so, you know, those little allusions are quite nice. But I was glad to see Ian McKellen in it. It is only for a short while, though, for anyone who's going to the film in order to see him. It is sort of, you know, go to the loo and you miss it. But it is really good for what it is.
And he does spend an awful lot of time telling Shakespeare he's the most wonderful thing since, well, they didn't really do sliced bread at that point. And I think that's...
Shakespeare...
Sorry.
Sorry, yeah.
I think to come back to what you were saying earlier, Joe, about... I'm not sure this film knows where it wants to sit sort of morally, in that you have this quite kind of cool moral about he goes back to Stratford and has to reconnect with his children, and that all is true is about kind of emotional truth. And then you have this really, you know, kind of great but sort of vignette-y scene of Ian McKellen as Wriothesley kind of cropping up to tell him he's the greatest thing in the world, and then you have a Ben Jonson figure come and do that later. And this, it doesn't quite fit into the sort of general like arc of the story.
Okay, Gemma, I'm interested in your perspective, because you said you loved it and you had a big smile on your face when we were talking about Ian McKellen. what is it, as somebody I suppose who's not a Shakespeare scholar, what does it make you feel and think about Shakespeare? Does it make you reevaluate what you knew about him or what you think about him?
I have to say, a lot of the stuff in the film I had no idea about. So it's a good job that you guys are here. But yeah, I actually thought it made Shakespeare seem like this really nice guy who you kind of feel a little bit, well, in some ways you feel sorry for him. It does make you kind of a bit of a roller coaster ride about this, because he comes back and he says all these kind of sweet, witty lines, and I don't know, I fell. But anyway, but then at the same time, you really feel for his family who have been without him for like 20 years or whatever period it is that he's been away. And they've just been, and there's a lot of reference to the fact that, well, things aren't done like this in London, you know, dear. And, you know, it's sort of, you can relate to that big pond, little fish kind of thing. And I just thought he was quite charming. But
is that because he's played by Ken Branagh?
I might have been swayed by that a little bit. And I am a fan of Ian McKellen. Something I really wanted to know was, so a lot of the film kind of focuses on these insecurities that Shakespeare had around his position in terms of his family background, so his father. And I think when the Earl of Southampton comes to see him, he mentions the fact that Shakespeare had to buy his own family crest because he didn't have one. And I wondered how true that was, if either of you know.
Pretty true. It's yeah, that's one of the things that I think is pretty accurate. So what kind of seems to have happened is that Shakespeare's father, John, was a bit of kind of potentially a bit of a wrong'un. He's presented to the sort of bishops for like in absentia for missing church, which it makes you a recusant, which is sometimes used as evidence that he was a Catholic. The reason kind of given by the people is that he didn't go to church because he was worried if he went to church, he'd be arrested for debt. So whether or not he was a thief, as gets implied, the film, that not entirely sure on, but he was certainly a debtor. But at the same time, he was like quite an important figure in the town. He was a bailiff at the church for a while. And he seems to have started this process to like get a family crest, to claim this family crest. And then William picks that up. So he kind of does buy this family crest. He also buys the second best house in Stratford. He likes second best.
He does, doesn't he? Yeah.
So he's like, he does kind of make himself. And I think having that idea that he's a little bit insecure about that works really well, actually. I think that is quite accurate in very heavy inverted commas, because this is fiction.
Well, I mean, if an hour and a half running time, a historical fiction film, at least they know their history.
Yeah, they absolutely do.
So they know the history. Joe, can I ask you about Hamnet? So Shakespeare's only son, who died, I think, 17 years prior to when the film is set. And
yes, I think that's right, yeah.
This is something that I was relatively unaware of. I think I've heard it in passing before. How much do you feel like it influenced his later work, and how realistically that's rendered in the film, do you think?
Yeah, again, it's something that historians and scholars have argued about a great deal, largely in relationship, unsurprisingly, Hamlet, and the similarity in the names there has not gone unnoticed. What we know about him is that he died of plague. As many children did. How are we for spoilers with this, by the way?
I reckon.
That's quite a twist in the film that's related to
this. It is the one twist.
I suppose, I mean, if it's something that happened in the 17th century, then...
Yeah, it's kind of over.
It's too soon,
I know what you mean. Do you know what? Should we just say it, and then if we think it's too twisty... We could bleep it.
Sure. All right. the suggestion that he might not have died of bubonic plague, and that was some sort of cover-up. There's the spoiler. Come back now if they were closing their ears. That it might have been something else. that's where they start going quite... There's two moments, and unfortunately they're related to the big plot twist in the film. There are two moments where they go quite off of any historical basis. And I think Kirstie actually can speak more to this because she's made a bit of a study of plague.
I can talk about buboes.
I think you should. the idea that they would have claimed that he had died of plague to cover up something else doesn't quite make sense, because you don't want people thinking that there's plague in your house. So in that one, it doesn't quite ring true. But the idea that it might have been devastating for him, absolutely. As historians, we've gone against the suggestion that used to be the case that people in that period didn't care about their children because, you know, they knew that they were likely to die. They had so many of them. They'd send them off to apprenticeships, whatever. Obviously, there was no actual love or familial feeling there. Historians have now rejected that. And the idea that someone would be actually distraught even 15, 20 years later about the death of a son does ring historically true.
I have to say that there was this kind of almost Henry VIII kind of parallel where he is so obsessed with his son. I mean, it throughout the film, he sees him or imagines seeing him all around the house and everything. And obviously he wasn't there for the period of mourning. But there is this thing about where he is absolutely transfixed by his son and he kind of discards his daughter because of that. Which is quite interesting. And there is another twist, but I'm not going to say it.
Yes, so many
I'm going to have to record a special twist alert jingle. Just in case.
Can I just say, I just glanced over at your notes and I can see at the top, why the stupid makeup?
And then there's a terrible bit of my writing underneath that says, you look like a Doctor Who villain, but not from the modern series.
So this is the prosthetic nose.
Yeah, the prosthetic nose. It's kind of like... Nicole Kidman in The Hours, and that it's very distracting. You end up looking at the nose quite a lot. And it's a sort of, I don't know, like, I think this could be a symbol for sort of what the entire film is doing. In that if you go and see this film, surely it is because you'd quite like to see Kenneth Branagh. Like, Kenneth Branagh has fans for good reason. He's a good actor. And everyone knows it's Kenneth Branagh. So why would you cover him up and make him look like the portrait? It's pretty much based on the portrait from the start of the First Folio. There's an engraved portrait. The engraved portrait is mad, right? Like, he's wearing a collar that doesn't make any sense in physics. So to try and ape that is kind of weird. And he ends up looking a bit like a Klingon.
It's slightly over the top as well, isn't it? Because it's not like Shakespeare, who's someone whose image is so in the public consciousness. Mm. It's not like when Richard Attenborough played Gandhi, for example. And you think, okay, there has to be a level of transformation here, because otherwise I'm not going to buy. Nobody's going to watch it and go, I'm walking out, because that's not Shakespeare's nose. It's slight overkill, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. He just needed to have slightly longer hair and that would have done it, I think. But sort of, because I think Joe has sort of promised that I'll talk about the plague there, and maybe I should.
We love the plague here.
Love the plague.
No one's ever sort of trailed the plague so sort of temptingly.
basically, it's... So part of, and not to spoiler too much, one of the reasons that the idea that Hamlet died of plague comes under doubt in the film is that you don't have other people dying of the plague. He's the only one in the town, supposedly, who's died of it. That's kind of possible. Because plague isn't spread, or at least the bubonic form isn't spread via human-to-human contact very much. So it could be that, you know, this flea that bit Hamlet didn't bite anyone else in the town, and ergo, he died of plague. And there's also the fact that, I mean, as far as I'm aware, there isn't a record of what Hamlet died of. It could have been pretty much anything. There was plague in 1596 when he died. There's plague every year. It's endemic in England. So that's a possibility. But to pick up what Joe said about that this isn't what you pretend to have, if somebody dies in your house of plague, I mean, how it's kind of framed in the film is that he's like covered in a cloth, and Anne Hathaway says he's died of plague, so nobody come near and look at him. thing is, that's not how unexpected death is treated in early modern England. If someone dies and nobody knows what it is, they have to be checked for plague, because there are sort of public health procedures that go into place. And you can catch plague from a plaguey dead body. Absolutely can, for several days. It's kind of horrible. It's still shedding bacteria for that time. Thing is, that's the idea that people would be too afraid to go near it isn't reckoning on the disposability of older women in early modern society. So you have these women known as the searchers, whose job it is to check dead people and to check houses in which people have died, and look and see if they have the plague signs, which are these kind of great buboes that you get in your armpits and your groin. And they're kind of doing it because people are like, well, they're old women, we don't really need them for anything. But also, on the other hand, because they have this like lay medical knowledge, they're kind of recognised experts. So if Hamlet had died of plague or not of plague and they decided to cover it up, the one thing you don't say is plague, because it's going to get found out. Mm. And also because if somebody is found to have the plague, that's when your house gets shut up. You're not allowed in or out. People have to come and deliver you like food and drink through a window. It's really not the thing you say.
Hassle.
It's a massive hassle.
How you get in the plague is such a hassle. I cannot tell you.
You do actually have people writing like that.
Yeah. I've only got the bloody plague. Oh.
I've got the plague. Plague's in my house. It's really annoying. You also, during a plague outbreak, you can't let people know you have any illness, because people will go, oh God, he's got the plague. Mm-hmm. So there's this writer, John Taylor, who I've worked on, who's a later writer, who writes during a plague outbreak in the 1620s. It's really awful because I have this ongoing illness where I'm really farty. He's really farty. But if I let anyone know that I've got it, they'll think I've got the plague and they'll shut me up in my house.
Oh. With his own farts.
With his farts.
Oh, the irony.
Open a window.
The irony. Can I ask, what's the life expectancy for a searcher?
Well, they're generally pretty elderly anyway. Mm. They do seem to have the same ones in parishes for quite a while. So they're quite hardy. And whether that's because they've got a measure of resistance against the plague, which is entirely possible, because you have these big outbreaks, but there's also periods of time where there's kind of one or two people dying in a parish every summer. So if these women have got to their kind of 50s, 60s, 70s, they've probably lived through a lot of plague. Mm.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, I want to see a film about them.
Yeah, I do love that.
That sounds amazing.
That's what Judy Dench should be doing in this film. Great.
Yeah, exactly.
All his bubos.
I just wanted to get the word bubos into the podcast.
Yeah, that's great.
It doesn't come up much in casual conversation, so yeah, I'm happy.
It does if you hang around with me.
just to finish, Joe, can I ask you, I suppose, as we've heard, the film knows its history but doesn't always stick to the facts that we know. But in terms of William Shakespeare, someone who's permanently in the public consciousness but maybe not for his personal life, what do you think the relevance of a film like this is, the relevance of Shakespeare is today?
That's a big question. I mean, obviously he is somebody who is known, you know, you study him in school. Maybe go to see some of his plays, and to understand well, first of all, that he was a person, he did exist.
He wrote some
plays. There was a person named William Shakespeare, and he wrote his plays. I think is maybe important because there are people who claim otherwise.
Yeah.
And part of that debate about whether or not he existed often has a sort of class or elite bent to it. The suggestion being that someone of his background could not have produced plays of such intelligence, such brilliance, and with the sort of references, the knowledge that he portrays in them. And I think one of the things that the film does is show that, yes, he came from a humble background, and the play suggests that he returns, in some sense, to a humble, normal person's background, but he still did produce things of great beauty that are still relevant and appreciated today. And I think that is a positive and important message.
I think you did a rather wonderful job. I put a huge existential question in your lap there, and I think you dealt with it.
Thank you.
Grand fashion. Kirsty, can I just ask you quickly, what would you say to anybody thinking about going to see All Is True?
If you're thinking about it, it probably means you're interested in Shakespeare, and this is going to open up some conversation. So, yeah, why not go and see it? I would say, yes, go and see it with a pinch of salt. Mm. Not necessarily around kind of, oh, we must, you know, learn history from this, but around things like... So one of the things that Kenneth Branagh actually said in a radio interview is that by shifting this focus onto Shakespeare's home life, onto his family, that it's about giving the women in his life a voice. I would say think of that critically when you go to see it. The idea that you have two 21st century male writer and actor, giving women a voice really kind of bothers me. And there are things that are like odd about the treatment of gender in it. There's a lot of stuff about, oh, women can't be writers. Women can be writers. Go read some women writers. So I think the thing that I would say to people going to see it is, yeah, do it. Like, it's worth seeing. It's very, very beautiful. There's great acting. But also, like, then come home and read some Amelia Lanya. That's what I'd say.
Okay. And watch out for the bubos.
Yeah. Don't get plague. Like, wash your hands a lot.
Fantastic. Dr. Kirsty Rolfe, Dr. Joanne Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's everybody's favourite part of the show. It's time for the well-researched, intellectually taxing idiom. Dr. Kirsty Rolfe is still with us. Are you ready to learn?
Kirsty? I am so ready to learn. I was born ready to learn.
Gemma, Gemma's got quite a positive outlook on life. Do you think this is going to be better?
I think it's, do you know what? Even if it's not better, I think Kirsty will be more polite about it than Estelle was.
Oh, I don't know. I could work up some anger.
I react very well to encouragement. That's all I'll say. Are you aware of the term bite the bullet?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Okay. Bite the bullet. Meaning to accept something difficult or perhaps unpleasant. You've just got to get on with it. You've got to bite the bullet. Well, I know I'm starting on shaky ground. In the olden days.
Oh, ye olden days.
Non-specific. So any time before right now. In the olden days, when doctors were short on anaesthesia or time, potentially, during a battle, according to my source, they would ask the patient to bite on a bullet to distract from the pain. The first recorded use of this phrase, in case you're wondering at home, and I know you are, was in 1891 in Rudyard Kipling's novel The Light That Failed. Bite the bullet. Today's idiom.
I don't think orthodontists would be very pleased with that.
Yeah, I feel like there's probably better things to bite, you know, with a bit more give to them.
Mm.
Do you think?
Well, and also, if these bullets are lead, which presumably they are at that point, like maybe you're going to survive the surgery and then die of lead poisoning.
What's it, porphyria? That's what it's called, isn't it? What King George has it. So the irony. The irony.
Just go mad from it. I mean, you wouldn't know whether it was the surgical trauma or the lead poisoning.
Having your leg amputated on the battlefield at Trafalgar, yeah.
Oh. Basically, a really bad day.
Gemma, what do you think?
I enjoyed it very much so.
Thank you.
I don't think I'll be doing it or testing it out.
No.
I agree with Kirsty. I think that I seem to feel that in all these films that I watch, which are probably completely inaccurate, people use softer materials, maybe like a piece of wood or something.
Yeah, it's probably got a lot of wood lying around in the boat.
Well, I've never heard the idiom to bite the wood.
that just means something very different.
Doesn't it just?
keep it clean, please.
If you have any questions or for some reason you doubt this week's idiom, info@viral-history.com. Right, it is of course competition time. What we want is reviews. Our favourite review on Spotify or iTunes or whatever jazzy place you guys listen to your podcasts will win a prize each week. Now, the winner of the prize last time was Shortlisten, who left their review on iTunes. Shortlisten, please can you email info@viral-history.com to claim your copy of Kate Williams' book on Mary, Queen of Scots. Up for grabs this week, Joanne Poole's book on Thomas More. All you need to do to be in with a chance of winning is to leave us a review. It's totally arbitrary. Five-star reviews, yes. Five-star reviews are the... Do you know what? If it's a four-star, we just burn them. That's how we fit. We print them off and burn them. That's how much.
It's a very historic. Like, I mean, that happens to some letters in the film, so it's all very relevant.
It all ties in. Leave us a review. Our favourite review will be in with a chance of winning that prize. Joanne Poole's Thomas More. Just leave us a review. Right, that's it for this week. If you want to get in touch, as always, it's Twitter @viral_history. Instagram is @viralhistory. Facebook and YouTube are quite simply Viral History. Or you can drop us an email, info@viral-history.com. Gemma, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to Dr. Kirsty Rolfe.
Thank you.
And Dr. Joanne Poole, thank you very much for joining us. I'm Joe Forrester, and we'll see you next time on the Viral History Podcast.